I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Adam Schatz. And before we get into today's episode, I'd like to tell you about Bluettes, a play opening next month at the Royal Court Theatre in London, starring Ben Whishaw, Emma Darcy, and Kayla Michael. Based on Maggie Nelson's book, Bluettes is a meditation on love and grief, a story about depression and desire, pleasure and pain, and a person obsessed with the color blue. It's adapted for the stage by Margaret Perry and directed by Katie Mitchell, and it runs at the Royal Court from 17 May to 29 June. Click on the link in the description to book tickets. Hello and welcome to the LRB podcast. I'm your host, Adam Schatz, and my guest on this episode is Hazel Carby. The subject of our conversation is Carby's recent LRB lecture, Remembering the Future, a reflection on a series of artworks by Indigenous, Native American, and First Nations artists depicting scenes of ecological catastrophe in North America. Hazel, it's great to have you on the podcast.
It's good to talk to you, Adam.
Hazel, your lecture begins with a description of an arresting photograph of the Four Corners power plant in New Mexico by the Diné artist Will Wilson. This photograph depicts a coal-fired power plant at the edges of the Morgan Lake in New Mexico. It's in a Navajo reservation, and it's this wide-angle photograph. We see the shimmering water. We see these enormous clouds, bits of blue sky, and the landscape just feels somewhat haunted, and we see the coal spewing out of the plant. This photograph, you can see online on the LRB's website. Can you talk about the photo and why you chose to launch your lecture with it?
Interesting question about why I started the lecture with it. I think because it contains so many of the contradictions that I wanted to elaborate upon later, and I will explain those. So what Will Wilson is doing in many of his photographic projects is to raise the question of the production of energy, which is the legacy of settler colonial governments in what is now called the United States, and what the cost has been for various peoples. So this particular plant and this particular photograph interested me because in many ways what a number of his photographs are addressing, in addition to the question of the pollution, is that the Diné themselves don't actually benefit from the production of energy on their lands. I think I talk about how they actually are. They produce energy for many of the cities in the Southwest, but I think a large percentage of people on the Navajo reservation itself still don't actually have electricity. So the inequalities built into this system, I think are very, very important. I think the other reason I wanted to start with the photograph is because Will Wilson is very committed, I think, to revealing in pictures through the photograph, through pixels, if you like, histories that cannot easily be seen. And so I talk about the photograph in detail because it contains, I think, many of the contradictions between what we think we're seeing and the history that is actually embedded in what we are seeing. An embedded history which I think extends to the silencing in general of so much Indigenous and Navajo and Diné history in general in the United States. So for a long time, I've been working on the questions of silencing.
Another contradiction that this photograph underscores is the contradiction between the reality of the Morgan Lake, which appears in the photograph, and its depiction in tourist brochures and on websites. This lake, you note, is an artificial formation that was built in the early 1960s to serve as a cooling pond for the plant, and swimming in it is now banned because of the contaminants.
Yes. And I think so much, again, of the tourist industry in the United States, whether it be here in Morgan Lake, whether it be lakes that have been produced because of damming of rivers, actually disguise their history, disguise sometimes the dispossession of Indigenous or Native groups to build a lake. And in this case, I think the difference is between, and I think the Grand Canyon in a way, which is not that far away from here, is another good example of the way in which there is a discrepancy between what tourists think they're seeing and indeed that this area, this lake or this canyon is in fact there for their use, a resource for them to use for their pleasure, but actually carries an embedded Indigenous history that they can't see. So I'm just very interested in how Will Wilson is committed to enabling us to see what we don't normally see. And that's why I talk a lot about the colours, the way in which he uses these tones in the photograph. They're very different from the sort of blue lake of tourist brochures or whatever. And so I'm partially arguing that his tones, the use of clouds, the greys, the dark blues, the way in which he emphasizes through contrast, you know, the coal and the way in which the lake looks, I think is to interrupt that tourist discourse, that tourist view of beauty, to ask us to think about what has actually produced this, what is the history that we are not seeing. And can, I think it's a real question, really, about whether art can, in fact, enable us to see histories that have been buried, have been silenced.
Well, it's interesting that he is a photographer because, you know, what you were just saying reminded me of an essay that Walter Benjamin wrote in the 1920s or maybe early 30s about surrealism, where he described the camera as a tool to unlock the optical unconscious. And I think what you're suggesting is that Wilson works as a kind of archaeologist with his photos to reveal the political unconscious of these formations.
The political unconscious, but also I think to ask viewers to think about the very material or the materiality of, for example, pollution, or the materiality of the long-term question of the production of energy for use. Who actually, I think, pays the price for that? Who, and this is why I think it's also material, it's about trying to imagine the consequences for bodies as well as the environment. And by that, I mean human beings, but also, you know, the range of the non-human the plant life, the land. And so I think his photographs are sort of meticulous in the detail. Even though people are not present, bodies, literal bodies are not present.
Well, speaking of plant life, you write that Wilson's photograph at its edges reveals a sienna of grasses blowing in the wind. And you say that the warmth of its colors speaks to life, the alternative meaning of plant, life generated, here I'm quoting you, life generated rather than life extinguished, in what you call slow violence, drawing upon the writer Rob Nixon. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. The first thing I would say is those fronds, those grasses in the front of the photograph are the only warm colors in the entire photograph, which I think is interesting. It immediately draws our eyes to the contrast. And so in a broader sense, I'm also very interested in how we can be brought to imagine the long-term consequences of and the legacy of settler colonialism in terms of the consequences of the conquering of people and the environment, of genocide and ecocide, hand in hand, that these are intimately tied together, whether we're talking about, you know, colonial Jamaica or we're talking about the colonization of the land we now call the United States. In a way, that is behind the question for me of the title about remembering the future. Because it seems to me, unless we do actually untangle and really understand the consequences of that past, we can't reshape a future for ourselves. Because in a way, the future is already this legacy of ecocide and genocide.
The next work that you describe is by the artist Jean Quictusee Smith, a member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. It's a painting of the map of the U.S., and the title is 50 Shades of White, and the wit doesn't end there. It's hard not to think of Jasper Johns' painting of the U.S. map, but something quite different is going on here. Can you tell us what Smith is up to in this painting?
Yes. So she has actually a series of paintings. It's one of many paintings where she is using an iconic shape. Jean Quictusee Smith is not using the word the United States, but she wants people to recognize the land masses and then reconfigure the history of what that really means in terms of what we're seeing. So she does have, I think, a very powerful political critique to make, but she also has this wonderful, you know, sense of humor. So the whitenesses are areas in the shape of what is now represented as individual states, but the names given to them are of the sort of paint cans you'd find in your local hardware store, you know, of the different. But she's making a very pointed critique, I think, about how whiteness comes to dominate and also the multiple meanings that it has. It's actually not just one meaning in that map, but there's a lot of embedded histories and amusing play with words, I think.
And she also alludes in that painting to places that have been removed from the map, doesn't she?
You mean in their erasure?
Right.
Well, okay, so in terms of the colours of the map, it's actually very interesting, I think, that although whiteness, when you first look at the map, appears to dominate, there's actually all these sort of dark browns and multiple shades of browns that seem to be appearing either through gaps or at the edges or whatever. So I think the more and the closer you look at the painting, the more you realize that actually whiteness has not successfully obliterated what was there before, even though it appears to be very, very dominant, which is obviously making us think about what can survive under the burdens of that whiteness.
And isn't it also, in a sense, making you feel what the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish called the presence of absence?
I like that phrase. I think that's exactly right. And I think that when you look at the painting, you start to actually question not what is there, but what is not there. She layers it in multiple ways. She has various sort of printed, I don't want to call them stickers, but sort of printed labels that she has put on that really reference different moments or different points of contention. One is actually about who is cast to be, you know, quote unquote, Indians or Native Americans in quotation marks. In Hollywood films, none of whom are actually indigenous peoples. She sort of lists all, you know, the way in which Hollywood avoids, or has been until recently, avoids doing that. And there are other sort of labels that sort of encourage us to think about various contradictions in history. So, yes, I like that label, the absent, yes. What is absent and what is present? I think that's exactly the question she wants viewers to think about.
If you enjoy the LRB podcast, you might also enjoy the We Society podcast from the Academy of Social Sciences. In each episode, Will Hutton untangles the grand challenges we face as a society, looking at them from a social science perspective. Will has gathered some of the UK's most groundbreaking and influential social scientists to ask how their research could help solve some of the country's and the world's most pressing problems. In Season 5, the We Society tackles Britain's ailing high streets, bankrupt councils, and the continued lack of disability inclusion, among other important topics. So if you want to hear research-led insights and solutions and a great conversation, listen and subscribe to the We Society on all podcast platforms. I want to ask you about another work by Will Wilson. It's a multimedia series called Autoimmune Response, or AIR. It was made between 2002 and 2021, so over almost a 20-year period. And in that series, Wilson depicts himself as a kind of post-apocalyptic survivor traveling through these empty landscapes of detritus and decay, the result of uranium mining and processing, nuclear weapons productions facilities and atomic test sites, what you've called the nuclear industrial complex. Reading these passages, I was reminded of Zabald's evocation of landscapes haunted by human and environmental catastrophes. Is Will Wilson our North American Zabald in these photographs?
I think that's a very interesting comparison, actually. Certainly, I am very, very influenced by Zabald, and possibly that's also evident in my interpretation. But this is, on Will Wilson's part, this is a very long-term commitment to exposing the consequences of the nuclear industrial complex. And it's, you know, his work, which I think the project is still ongoing, perhaps in a slightly different form, because he is now producing photographs about the abandoned uranium mines, over 500 of them. But in these particular photographs, I think it's very interesting that he uses a protagonist who always has exactly the same clothes on and equipment and breathing mask or whatever. And I think his photographs ask people to, again, interrogate themselves about not just what they're seeing, but why they're seeing it and what they are not seeing.
And how they might be complicit in it, I suppose. I mean, I think that the distinction you're making is that he's describing an ongoing catastrophe, unlike Zabald, who was writing about ruins and something that had happened in the past.
Yeah. No, Will Wilson is very much, in his work, in his photographs, is thinking about the future as well as the legacy of what is creating this future. So yes, absolutely.
I mean, these photographs, these artworks that you describe in this lecture are chronicling horrors, both past and present, horrors that really impinge on any future horizon. And yet at the same time, they're often quite beautiful. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of a photograph that you write about by the Tewa Hopi artist, Michael Naminga. It's called Altered Landscape. And in this photograph, yellows and reds are used to throw into bold relief the methane cloud over the Navajo Nation. Now, if you didn't know what the photograph was depicting, you might just think it was a spectacular vista. And the beauty seems to be almost inseparable from the horror it depicts.
I think, yes, actually, I think that's true. I'm not sure I would use the word beauty, but I certainly would use the word stunning or arresting, in that it completely, you know, when you see it, it makes you stop. The other thing I would say is that methane is invisible. So one question, and this is a question that Will Wilson is also asking in his work, is how can you make visible through photographs what is not visible, either because it's been silenced by history or because it is being carried by the air, by the wind, penetrating the soil and animals, and has, in terms of, you know, uranium, an extraordinarily long life. I mean, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of years here. With the methane and with Naminga's photographs, what he's also chosen to do, which I think is arresting, is to fracture the photograph. So one of the things he wants to do to get your attention is to move beyond photographs just being flat. So in addition to actually colouring the methane so it can be seen, he fractures a photograph by putting it on plexiglass, which is, it's still actually 2D, but it appears to you, as he's divided the photograph into different units, as if it is 3D. So you're moving around it like a sculpture. And I think there's the way in which the fracturing contests what people may immediately think of as beauty. But then think about, well, why is this, in fact, I was going to say, sort of like fracturing or having this consequence on the earth, which is actually, it's a sort of geological fracturing is what it makes you think of. So those things, I think, work simultaneously to prompt the viewer to ask what they really are seeing here. And of course, methane pollution is a very, very urgent contemporary issue.
So you're saying the very form of this work, the kind of faux 3D quality or sculptural quality that it has, provokes a more sustained attention in the viewer?
I think so, because we are so used to accepting that photographs are just flat surfaces, right? That they work in a certain way. And I think the question of form is an interesting one, because we inherit our understanding of what photographs, what artwork is meant to do, just as we inherit other sort of beliefs that are legacies of settler colonialism. So if we interrupt those formal qualities, then the viewer has to actually be brought up short and think, what is this photograph doing? This is not the flat, usual landscape, particularly as they have been photographed and painted in the US, of these empty, beautiful canyons or whatever, emptied of people.
Vistas without people.
Yes, but emptied, not empty, but emptied. And of course, I mean, one of the other things that Michael Naminga is doing is playing with our understanding of Georgia O'Keeffe's paintings of that area. So in some ways, it's like Jean Quittesy Smith. There's an iconic landscape. We think we know. We think we expect how we are going to see it. And that is being refused. That is being refused by all three artists here.
Mm. I mean, what you're suggesting, though, with Naminga and also with Jean Quittesy, is that these works, while they're, of course, commentaries on these human-made ecological catastrophes, that they're also in conversation with a history of American / Western representation of these areas, whether it's George O'Keefe's paintings of the Southwest or, let's say, Jasper Johns's paintings of the American map.
Yes. So ask yourself this. If we are to interrupt and contest so much of the history that we receive, if we want to tell our stories, or if we want to represent our landscapes in a way that does contest that history, why would we use dominant forms of representation that have been used to silence us or to avoid our histories? And this is a question that I have been interested in for a long time, whether we're talking about literary narrative, prose form, or whether we're talking about art. And I think that what we have to do is to find new ways of talking about this artwork, which is so challenging, because they don't fit the format that dominates, for example, so much art criticism or history of art criticism, which is, you know, modernism versus traditional, certain ways of presenting landscapes or whatever. So if we really want to interrupt those histories which have rendered us silenced or absent, then we are finding various new forms. And this is, you know, the what I'm working on now is thinking about the way in which Indigenous and Black artists are doing that and challenging us in the process to see in new ways. But I think form is a crucial question here. Yes.
You know, one of the terms that gets tossed around to describe works such as these is, you note, Indigenous futurism, which is catchy, but also about as vague as the term that probably inspired it, Afrofuturism. Do you think that these works have anything in common, formally speaking? I mean, I can see the ways in which they relate to practices of artistic subversion, whether it's surrealism or Dada or Brechtianism or many of the techniques that we see in contemporary art. But do you think, aside from subject matter, there's something that links the works that you're describing in this lecture? Do you think that we could speak of Indigenous futurism? Is that a meaningful category?
I have not been using it very deliberately so. I always think we need to ask who and why people are imposing these terms and what work they think they are doing with it to group people in this way. But I would say that the frameworks and the forms and the historical references are not actually back to the examples that you've been being given, whether we're talking about surrealism, whether we're talking about romantic painting. What I think so many of these Black and Indigenous contemporary artists are doing are challenging ways of seeing in more fundamental terms. So we actually have to think about new curatorial languages that don't just refer back to Western histories of art as they have been understood, but are forging new directions. And that's why I was echoing the term that Will Wilson uses when he describes the work that his students think they're doing in terms of sort of remembering the future. He was very taken, I think, and influenced by that, because that language was invested. It was invested in, committed to, I should say, an openness to completely new forms which took account of tradition at the same time as it was acknowledging that tradition is not actually something only in the past, but that is constantly changing and being worked through. So, you know, the frameworks, I think, reference other histories, Indigenous histories and experiences of settler colonialism of displacement, of dispossession, which are not dominant Western ways of understanding or interpreting. So I think when thinking about these works of art, it's actually good to look at the frameworks of interpretation that these artists themselves are using as a reference.
Do you think that by virtue of their experiences of land confiscation, colonization, resettlement, Native American and First Nations artists are especially well qualified to serve as witnesses of the violent and destructive side of capitalist modernity?
Well, certainly they are witnesses to that, and witnessing it in multiple ways, not just through visual art, but through literature, through political organizing. Many Indigenous people, First Nations people, various tribal groups in the US and in Ecuador and in Nigeria are actually part of an Indigenous network, for example, of opposition to fossil fuels. So there's a very strong political movement that is going along with what is actually happening in art. I mean, the protest against fossil fuels is only one example, but I use it because I think people forget who is actually on the front lines of this opposition at the moment, an opposition which is determined to save the future for all of us. I think we all have a stake in this, and we need to sort of recognize what it is about these histories and these witnessing to these histories that should make us ask where we stand.
You've decided in this lecture to focus on visual art. And in our conversation, you've talked about the challenge of rendering visible something that is invisible, such as the methane gas. I'm wondering, why do you think you decided here to focus on visual art and photography, painting and photography, rather than, say, literature or another medium? There's a rich tradition in Native American literature, for example, that has drawn attention to some of the same issues. Why visual art? Is there something about visual art and what it tells us that's uniquely powerful?
Well, it was a lecture, and I wanted to make it coherent. And so three visual artists who were doing this particular work, I thought, were opening up. Well, what I wanted to do was to open up questions in the audience for them to pursue further. The project I'm working on, of course, considers literature. I mean, how could you not? And not just the rich production of Indigenous literature, but also Black literature too. At the moment, I'm writing a comparison between the work of Michael Nwinga and N.K. Jemisin.
The Black science fiction writer, right?
Yes. If you think of a novel like Fifth Season, she is accomplishing formal interruptions in what we expect of a novel in a way similar to Michael Nwinga interrupting formal expectations of photography. And so, yes, so there's a number of literature, yes, poetry, yes, paintings, yes, photography, absolutely, yeah. But, you know, in terms of a lecture, it's always thinking about making what is a sort of coherent for an audience, not taking on too much, but opening up questions that they can ask. Hopefully that they can pursue those questions further themselves. But yes.
I finally have a question about you, Hazel. You're best known, indeed renowned, for your writing on the history of Black women, about the legacies of colonialism in the West Indies, about racial capitalism. And of course, the history that you evoke in this lecture is related to your previous work, but it's also distinctive, if not a departure, since your focus is here on First Nations and on the relationship between capitalism, empire, and the environment. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about how this subject came to attract your attention and perhaps why today, in this era of climate change and global warming, it feels so urgent to you.
Well, you've answered the question about why it's urgent, right? But I would also say, You know, I've been building questions of the environment into my work for a long, long time. It's evident in imperial intimacies and the way in which we think about colonialism as dominating both nature and peoples at the same time. So it is an extension of that. But I also think it's extremely urgent in the United States at this time to interrupt many, many ways in which questions of indigeneity are being gestured to, but not fundamentally challenged. So, for example, here at Yale, every time there's a public event now, and people are supposed to use this land acknowledgement, which has been, I mean, to call it pathetic, doesn't even begin to get at how weak it is. But also, land acknowledgements are being written without any consultation with Indigenous peoples now, which is another way of thinking about the buried history, particularly of the United States, that people imagine that First Nations people, tribes, that this is in the past. This is, they're all dead. They're invisible. They're not alive. They're not actually around us. They're not shaping the future of their nations and of this nation. I would also say that one of the things I've done in terms of thinking about what is called African American studies is always think in a much broader context about Black studies, in a diasporic context. And so I think it's very important and urgent that we broaden how we're thinking about questions of racialization and the environment and the history of, well, Black history in all its complications, but in relation to Indigenous histories, because these are not separate. These are very, very tied together. And I think one of the problems is the languages of these fields, settler colonialism used in Indigenous history, enslavement used in, you know, African-American history, disguise actually how we need to think about the enslavement, you know, of Indigenous peoples here in what was then called, you know, New England, or in the South, for example, as well as the way in which these communities found multiple ways to join with each other, to be in solidarity or to be in contestation. So,
I mean, it's not uncommon for Black Americans to have Native American ancestry. I just think
of,
you know,
it's very common.
The pianist Cecil Taylor was part Cherokee. Right.
It's very, very common. But also, the history, if you're actually thinking of the dispossession of the land of Native Americans, what is then put on that land? But plantations for the enslaved. So the question of the environment, the question of the land, the question of dispossession, at all levels, I would like African-American, Black history and Native history, Indigenous histories, to be in conversation with each other in a much broader way.
To go back to that remark that you made about the land acknowledgement ceremonies that precede any event at Yale or so many other colleges, it occurred to me that the lack of consultation of Indigenous communities, well, it suggests that the land acknowledgement is a kind of addition to the monologue of the dominant society. This is the story that it continues to tell itself, and that what you're arguing for is, you know, what you've called at numerous points in this conversation a strategic interruption.
Yeah.
Do you think that's, in a sense, the role of an intellectual to interrupt a conversation or a monologue of the powerful? Is that what intellectual work is for you?
It's what my intellectual work is. I think it's a critical stance that's absolutely essential, and one I've always taken, yes. And I think, you know, instead of land acknowledgements, we need statements that this is stolen land. It's stolen land. That's it. And then work from there.
Well, Hazel, it's been a pleasure to talk to you about this brilliant talk that you gave, which can be read now in the London Review of Books. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome, Adam. It's a pleasure to talk to you as always.
You can read and watch Hazel's lecture on the LRB website and on the LRB YouTube channel.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.